Welcome to the Screamcast, episode 64. I am Sean DeRager, and with me is BJ Colangelo.
Hi.
And I think Brad Henderson's here somewhere, too.
Shitties, yes.
Jeez. Is this going to go on through the shitties?
Until we get to 69, and then it has to be, like, sexy.
I'll work on some audio
We
clips.
All have to talk in
we
900.
Totally have to do a Vinegar Syndrome episode.
And I'm going to make really awkward. It's going to be like, you want to talk about some boys in the sand? Let's talk about some boys in the sand.
And they have to watch my first vintage porno.
Oh,
me too.
I will out-smut the both of you.
Jesus Christ. I am looking forward to Andretting that episode at the same time.
It's already on the fucking schedule. I'm working on it right now.
Okay, do it.
That
will be awesome. Good call.
Because I mentioned that, I think, on our very first Vinegar Syndrome episode, is why didn't they make a sex title for number 69? It turned out to be like Christmas Evil or some shit.
Right.
And I was like, man, what a fucking missed opportunity that was.
They've been consulting with Bill from Code Red on how to number their spines.
No, they
That's
haven't.
That's not
because,
nice.
Because
it's a joke.
Vinegar Syndrome are filled with wonderful, amazing human beings that
I know.
We love dearly.
No, I know. I just, they made one miscalculation on the spine number that,
That's fine. I'll blame James for that.
God damn it.
What did they miscalculate?
The 69 on the spine.
Oh, that bullshit? Oh, I thought you meant, like, legitimate. I was just giving fucking hard time.
Oh, no.
You know, you're not like Bill where you have five movies released under Code Red, but you have number 67 on one of them. Fucking douchebag.
All right, before this turns into the anti-Code Red podcast.
You're so angry.
Jesus Christ. We have a fantastic show lined up for you here. We're going to be talking to Bill Lustig, and I am jazzed to be on Jazz. I'm jizzed to talk to Bill Lustig.
That's weird.
I might cry. There might be actual tears.
But first, everyone, I'm not used to having three people on the podcast as much. I'm kind of a little discombobulated. By the way, we are trying to get Brian, out of his, cage so he can be on the show with us in a few weeks, a couple weeks. I'm working on it. I need to lure him out slowly. He's been working on that documentary though. He's been doing some interviews and stuff on his documentary he's working on. So, hopefully he has some information on that when we have him on. All right. First,
some candy.
Stop offering strangers candy. They're going to take you away from humanity.
I want to know both of you. So what's on your doorstep? What we got to do?
Nothing. Fucking mat. Doormat is dirty.
My doorstep came in the form of the internet because no one ever wants to send me any hard copies of anything anymore. But on my doorstep, I got Jason Trost's new film, How to Save Us.
Mm.
And I am pretty ride or die for J. Trost's filmography. You may know him from The FP, All Superheroes Must Die, also known as Versus, and then Wet and Reckless. And the thing that I respect the most about him is that no two of his films are anywhere near the same genre, style, cinematography, plot. It's so different that you can't even pin it down, with the exception that he's in all of them. It's impossible to look at a film and go, oh yeah, that's a Jason Trost film. Like you can't, because he's so all encompassing with his subject matter. But How to Save Us, I think, is his most mature and most accessible of all of his films. And I think I was more blown away by how much he's grown as a filmmaker than anything. My review for it is on Halloween Love, which is one of the sites that I write for. You can find it there, but it's really beautiful and it's very, very touching. It's a post-apocalyptic film that, instead of it being like zombies, it's like these ghost-type creatures, but they're not really ghosts. It's like an entirely new mythos of a creature, which, kudos to him for that. And I'm kind of a champion for anybody who makes a film on a shoestring budget, and this is a film that was made by four people with 20 grand, and it's fucking awesome. It's easily my top five of the year so far. It doesn't matter that it was made for $20,000. It doesn't look it. It doesn't feel like it was. It's fan-fucking-tastic. And if people don't start seeing him as, you know, the powerhouse that I truly believe he has the potential to become, then, like, they're really missing out. I mean, don't look at a film like The FP and be like, oh, it's, you know, a bunch of shitty white kids. Like, no, he's so smart. And How to Save Us, like, really, I think, is going to help legitimize him as a filmmaker.
Whoa.
Wow.
Yeah. Hashtag rant.
I have nothing.
Sorry,
I mean, I haven't
really
seen the film.
I've heard about it a lot.
No, it's perfect. That yeah. Welcome to the club. But you know, yeah. I mean, I saw the FP. I actually wasn't. I'm still like kind of on the fence with the FP. I mean, I enjoyed for the most part, but you know, there's a few things that turned me off. But I've revisited it, and it's a decent film. But I did like Superheroes Must Die, though. I thought that was very entertaining for what it was.
Yeah,
so,
I really
I'm excited to see this one.
Yeah, I've only seen the FP.
It's fantastic. And it's like, if you were to take the FP, like, say the FP was, like, you know, in left field, How to Save Us is, like, so far on the right field, It's, like, across the street at the check cash place down the road. Like, it's so not in the same world that you almost can't believe that it's made by the same guy. And, you know, J.Tro stars in it, which he does all of his films, and you know, the FP is very much like making fun of shitty white trash white people, and this is just, it's so personal and authentic, and like he's really given it his all, and he's doing a great job in it. Like his performance is fantastic. And for those who don't know any of his films but might know him as an actor, he's the sheriff with the eye patch in Hatchet 3. Because that's the thing, he wears an eye patch, not for fashion, for realsies. but yeah, he's really, really good, and it's just a smart film, and I really hope that more people can see it. I know that it's going to have some really shitty reviews in a newspaper. He was posting about it today that this one review that's like really bad is going out to 90 newspapers, and it's clearly by somebody who just didn't get the movie. So I know a lot of us who have seen it already that are kind of the, you know, the web publicity, we're like trying to combat it. Like, no, 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 I swear to God, it's really good. So if you see a bad review of it in your newspaper, number one, are you 90 and still reading a newspaper? number two, ignore it because it's really great.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Anything else?
I saw a film, it's coming out on VOD tomorrow, but it's been out for a couple of years, called Doomsdays. It's by, oh God, my brain is not working. Sorry, cancer brain, it does some stuff sometimes. it came out in 2013, it's coming out on VOD tomorrow, and it's a pre-apocalyptic film. It's about these two guys, very similar to kind of like the Battery style, like buddy.
I was just gonna
comedy.
Say, like, the poster looks like The Battery.
Yeah, it's kind of like that. But it's about like two guys that believe in the peak oil sort of conspiracy theory that, you know, we're so dependent on oil that when it runs out, like, the world's going to implode, basically. So they're using that as their reason to not have a real job, not, you know, own anything, and they just go through, you know, like different rich homes and just kind of live as squatters, and like they're not trying to like loot or vandalize. They're just like, well, the world's going to end, who needs to buy a house when I can sleep in these rich people summer homes? And it's just quirky enough to where you see what they're doing with it, and you're kind of annoyed by the hipsterish nature of it, but it's not so ham-fisted that you don't want to watch it anymore. So I think that it's a really good balance for, I think, people closer to like my age generation, where we have like this weird mumblecore hipstery, like Wes Anderson-y type love affair with films like that. But at the same time, it still feels very grounded in reality and not like it's like a Wes Anderson film that doesn't wink to the camera, if that makes any sense. The humor is really dry, but it was entertaining, and it's very episodic. It doesn't really have a like a linear plot line. It's just kind of like here they are for these couple of days. But it's a small four-person cast, and it's funny as hell, and it's definitely, a film for the new millennial era kind of people. So I think that it'll do really well with kind of the 20 to 25-year-old age bracket, maybe for like some of the hipper 30-year-olds, and everyone else is gonna hate it. But if you like kind of the Wes Anderson-y films that aren't so Wes Anderson they hurt, I think you'll like it a lot.
I hope I'm one of the hip 30-year-olds that like
You want to be a hip 30-year-old? You want to be old man yet?
it. No.
You act like one.
Holding on. Holding on to it. Brad,
Yeah. Oh, me?
do you have anything?
I have quite a bit,
Oh, God.
but I'm gonna go through it really quick. I mean, because there's some things on here that I just don't want to talk about that I have to. All right, so my first one is Alexa Vega
Oh, Lord.
is in Roommate Wanted, and it has her face, and she's looking all serious, and it says Misery Seeks Company. This is a girly comedy, like let's fight in our apartment movie. It's really bizarre. You look at the back, she's like hold the knife and everything. Basically, she wants to go to school and she doesn't have the scholarship to do so. So she's going to donate her eggs in order to make some extra money.
That's a quick
And
10 grand.
yeah, well, then her friend, who she makes this little snarky comment to her because she's, the rich girl, her friend is, and she knows, she's like, well, some of us have to work for a living. And then she decides to donate her eggs too. So the girl that comes to evaluate them likes them both, and then it all goes down. Have you ever seen 2LDK? No
Oh,
one? No.
no.
Okay, well, it's about these two girls that fight in their apartment. And
That's probably why I
anyways,
haven't seen it.
well, it's actually decent, but this take kind of takes that and makes it kind of a slapstick comedy. So looking at it, you're like, oh man, it's going to be like she's going to trap her in there, and it's going to be some really jarring stuff. I didn't. It's Alexa Vega, so I wasn't think it was going to be great or anything. But watching it, I'm like, wow, this is totally not what they're promoting on the front cover and what it sounds like.
Is it intentionally slapstick, or did that just kind of happen?
No. It's intentional. It's just the way it's set up is just that they, I don't think they knew how to promote it, so they want to promote it as kind of a thriller, but it turns out to kind of be kind of a girly comedy in a way, but with
So
a little bit of blood and shit.
is it like we're promoting it as single white female, but really we're giving you Nurse 3D? Is it like that?
No. I mean, it's promoting it as a single white female. Exactly. It's actually a good point. Without even seeing the movie, you hit it head on. But no, it's just like, oh, I'm going to do this. Oh my God, you pulled my hair. I'm going to throw a plate at you. That type of shit.
Okay, I'm into this already.
Yeah. So, pass. The next one I have is The Poltergeist of Borley Forest, which
God,
is
dear
released by
God.
Image.
What kind of stuff do you get sent?
I get. Dude,
How do you get on these lists?
I literally have like 100 things I have to watch, and a lot of it's by Image. So, anyways, I have
Wait, the poltergeist of what?
the Poltergeist of Borley Forest.
I'll never
All right,
remember
so no, don't.
that.
So, anyways, it feels this is what it feels like. It feels like Image buys these films, and then they sit on them and they wait for something like Poltergeist to come
Oh.
out.
They're turning
So they
into that one
release it
company.
with another title. So they're kind of doing what Asylum does, but they have already acquired the movies. Because what reading about this movie is called like You Will Belong to Me or something like that. And being that Poltergeist comes out, they want to retitle the Poltergeist of Borley Forest. I kind of think the same thing happened with we had John Portanova on the show who did the Invoking. kind of the same thing, where that movie is called Cedar Ridge, but we want to promote it as some kind of spinoff of The Conjuring. Mm. And I think Image does that. This movie was filmed in Florida, so it sucks. That's it. No, it's just really, really bad. It's kind of it feels like maybe the kid that got made fun of that listened to the Panic of the Disco in the corner of his high school made it. So
fun fact, I was rocking the fuck out to Panic at the Disco about an hour and a half ago. So well, I might love this movie.
No, you won't. No, it's like one of those, like, hey, I'm a teenager. Okay, oh my god, there's a ghost then. After me. Oh,
that's
my god.
The worst.
Yeah, the other one I got is from IFC called Asmodexia.
Oh, fuck,
I was already intrigued. I was already intrigued by the title of the film, and the front cover looks fucking ridiculous.
Is it because Asmodexia sounds like ass to mouth sex? Because that's what I think got your attention.
I'm thinking of something else. Yummy.
Gross.
Hold on, I need to go get some mouthwash in my mouth.
I got something else. this is a Spanish film, which doesn't use those Spanish tropes of making everything so, oh, look, everything's so pretty at the end. This movie's fucking raw. It hits you right in the face. It's basically a family dealing with an exorcism over a 5-day period. And it's one of those things that you can't give anything away, but, man, it fucking hits hard. And it's really, really good. Great cinematography, great acting, just how it's pieced together over this period of time is so short. It can really, it really did a number on me, especially towards the end. I thought the final twist was incredible. But yeah, it's just one of those films that it really utilizes the, you know, kind of the cinematography and kind of the setting. Making it kind of really dark and gray, and I don't know. I just thought it was a kick-ass little spin on Exorcist, kind of Exorcist movie with ghosts and goblins. Sorry. But ghosts and shit. yeah, I recommend it. The other one I got was a very, very boring Western called The Quiet Gun by Olive Films. It was basically Lee Van Cleef comes to town, and he is kind of stirring up the pot, and kind of the sheriff takes matters in his own hands, and it just equals out to a huge bore. It's one of those films that Olive is just slapping in on Blu-ray just to slap it in, and it costs $20-some. And I honestly don't see this thing selling 20 copies. Because it's not like they're going back and they're releasing, you know, some fan favorites and shit. They're just going through MGM's catalog and re-releasing shit. Well, this is actually Paramount, it says on the back. Wait, how do they get a Paramount movie when no one else will let Paramount license out shit?
Maybe Paramount was even like, this is a crock of shit, get rid of it.
Yeah, no, it's just not a very good movie. I mean, the cover's pretty cool. You know, I saw Lee Van Cleef was going to be in it, so I kind of shown some interest, but it's just very dull and boring. It has a kind of, during the whole courtroom scene when they're trying to decide who's going on, the sheriff goes in and there's just a bunch of ruckus, so he just starts shooting at the ground, and I thought that was really funny.
So it's the A team,
huh?
So it's the A team, question mark?
No, not at all. It's funny because it says in tradition of High Noon, and it's not even close to Gary Cooper's badassness in High Noon. But anyways, definitely a pass if you like Westerns and you see this cover, you're like, oh, cool. It's going to be kind of a Lee Van Cleef, Zapata Quiet Gun movie. No, or not Quiet Gun. Shit, that's the name of this movie. What was the other? Whatever. He's in every Western, it seems. Next, I finally got around to watching Headless, which is the spinoff of Found. The film in Found is called Headless.
I am really curious to hear what you think about this.
So I'm a huge, huge, huge fan of Found. I think it's definitely one of the best. You know, it's funny because I'll call something C-grade. It doesn't mean it's bad. One of the best C-grade films ever. And it's up there with just being a legitimately like great coming to age story about two brothers, and he finds out his brother's a serial killer. Well, one of the films he's inspired by, because he watches old horror films, and this is not it's obviously made up for the movie, but these filmmakers decided to take it to another toll and make the film within a film an actual film. And it's nothing but what you would think it would be from C-grade films. It's nothing but just, hey, let's take this murder scene and extend it for an hour and a half, have no depth to our character. They try. Have you seen this, BJ?
I have, and here's why I'm allowing you to talk and not interrupting, is the fact that I know personally or have worked with like 90% of that cast.
Yeah.
So when they announced they were doing it, my first thoughts were very similar to yours, is like, you're kind of destroying the beauty of what made Found so great, was sort of that ambiguity and how it was a coming of age story. And now you're just making a run of the mill slasher film, but they were all so excited about it and they're so happy. And you could, you know, if I wanted to, I could buy my friend's head on eBay. And it's like, shit, I can't review this movie because I'm either going to hurt my friend's feelings or I'm not going to be honest, or it's going to put me in a really weird position. So that's why I'm really interested to hear what you have to say to see if you agree or not.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to get a copy from my buddy Marcus Koch, who had this like limited 300 or something. And yeah. I mean, it's a hell of a pack. I mean, they did a hell of a job self-producing these fucking Blu-rays. It's got condoms
also,
in
Marcus
it
rules
shit.
Our life.
Yeah, no, but it's got two condoms and it's hilarious. But I'm gonna rub the condoms together on air. That's their condoms, people. God. I mean, they did a beautiful job putting it together. The beginning of the film starts off as what we see in Found, but it's very, you know, just cut spliced together during the credit sequence, and then it dives into the mass killer who is basically abducting people and tearing them apart limb by limb. And it gets very brutal. They try to do some depth with the character, the lead killer, of, you know, why he might be a killer and his upbringing. And it's kind of the standard story of serial killers that you hear in real life, you know, being abused. And, you know, it takes it to a new level. Like his like sister like pisses on him and he's like trying to drink it and shit. It just tries to go to that level of like, oh my God, this is crazy, but it doesn't capture anything that Found did. And not saying that it should or try to do that, but if you're going to make the movie within a movie that, you know, is in Found, you think that you would try to emulate a little bit of what Found provided, and it didn't.
Right.
And that was a little disappointing, because this becomes the run-of-the-mill C-grade bullshit that we see, that we can buy at every convention. Now, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with C-grade movies, but they're more or less made to be shocking, and oh my God, I can't believe, you know, made for gorehounds. And this is exactly what this film is. I mean, the whole scene where he, like, you know, the beginning of the film, he chops off a girl's arms and legs, drags the legs, goes home, has the head, punches out the eyes, puts his dick in the esophagus, and really fucks his head to no end. And to the point where cum is actually coming out of the esophagus after he's done. It kind of goes above and beyond. And that's not what Found was about. Yeah, Found had some really like graphic shit, but at least there was kind of a story and reasoning behind it. The guy's abused and headless, and he's had a bad life, and he becomes a serial killer. But we don't care about who he's killing, what it's about, and it tries to be something special, especially with the skull boy that keeps showing up. Like, that's supposed to be him? Is he supposed to be little? Is it supposed to be, you know, just, you know, somebody watching in the distance in his mind? What is that? And it tries to capture something kind of, I don't want to say creative because that's kind of a shitty thing to say. I'm going to say creative. Because it's a shitty thing to say. But I think they try to be too creative and try to create something that's not there to kind of try to be different. And they can't do it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's headless. But if you're a fan of the C-grade, let's tear people up for fun.
Yeah, you'll love
you,
it. Absolutely. Because
it's got some pretty graphic stuff. And it is kind of fun at times. Like, it's not a bad movie. It's just
not what Found was.
Yeah, and that's kind of – and you have to play – like, a movie doesn't harm another movie, but you can't – you know, it's the same thing. You just can't talk about Headless without talking about Found, you know?
Right.
They go hand in hand too much. As a standalone movie, no, it's not that bad. But as kind of a spinoff from Found, it doesn't even compete.
Correct.
Hmm. So, moving along. Next is from Olive Films, It, The Terror from Beyond Space. This is a fun little, you know, spinoff Corman film. I mean, it's exactly like every other, you know, black and white space alien movie. It emulates the thing from Another Planet a lot, you know, just kind of... almost like what if Roy Rogers was in a fucking space alien movie from the 50s? That's what this is. It's just, it's silly, it's fun, it has those kind of creepy moments if you're in the 50s sitting back and, you know, in the drive-in. It's a drive-in black and white alien movie. So if you're a fan of that kind of old stuff like that, like the Roger Corman, this is definitely for you. And it's very short. It's like 69 minutes or so. It's 69. There you go.
But,
you know, it's just a fun little flick. I mean, nothing special. I mean, you've seen them all, but if you're a fan of that stuff, it's definitely for you. Another film that I've never seen this movie, and this is definitely one of the best movies I've seen this year, is Robert Townsend's Hollywood Shuffle. Holy shit, this movie's great. This makes fun of, and even still to this day, it hits the notes of the stereotypical, like, black people in cinema. And Robert Townsend does a great job. It's a slapstick comedy of going. I mean, he's obviously, it has one, it has a few different stories. One is a linear story where he is, plays Bobby Taylor, where he's trying to make it in Hollywood. He lives with his mom. He has a kid. And he's really trying to push. He does like commercials but he's always playing that token black guy. But in the side, in his mind, he has these little spinoffs of where he's, you know, in bigger movies, or he's in commercials. He's a film critic. He's making fun, and they're making fun of black people in films and cinema. But it's written by Keenan Ivory Wayans, if that tells you anything, who's done, you know, Living Color and wrote wrote Scary Movie. But you know, it's just great, because it's one of those things where, you know, they even say, "Oh man, you're not acting black enough," and they have this black acting school where these white people are teaching black people how to act more black. But it's just a great look at kind of how black people are portrayed in Hollywood, even still to this day. And this movie is made in 1987.
Wow.
And it still hits the mark today. I was cracking up because I was like, "This is so fucking funny." But yeah, it's like you look at it and you think you're going to get a slapstick, you know, 80s quirky comedy, but it actually has a lot of heart and meaning to it, especially the fucking end, because it really makes you realize kind of what black people. And this is exactly, I would throw this movie in with the Tyler Perry bullshit, because I think Tyler Perry is making a setback for black people in cinema. There, I said it.
Yes.
Fucking sue me. But anyways, yeah,
well,
we
you're
all
not
wanna...
wrong.
Yeah, no, I know, but I'm just, you say that, like, Tyler Perry's great, you know, you're just saying that because you're white and you don't understand. No, I fucking understand, because I'm a fan of black exploitation cinema. I'm a fan of fucking black people in cinema, and I'm a fan of this fucking movie. So, if you talk any shit, watch Hollywood Shuffle and I'll put you in your place. Boom. The next one is, that was by Olive Films, by the way. The other one is by Olive Films, which is one of my favorite 90s sex comedies, is fucking Ski School, which stars Dean Cameron, is the most lovable motherfucker in the world, because he has such the greatest smile in the history of smiles. But he plays Dave Marshak, who leads a ski school, and it's basically your fucking – it's your teen movie. There's two different groups of people that ski, and one is the crazy, you know, let's party, and they have a filthy room, and the other one is all, like, rich and bullshit, and they race on the hill. And it's got titties. It's got some great comedy. It's just all around a very, very fun sex comedy that never lets up and never has that drag. And that always stood out because I did a sex comedy project. I'm still doing it, by the way, because there's like 180 sex comedies from between 1975 and like 93. But anyways, I've watched all those, sadly enough. And a lot of them are great. And this is truly one of the great ones. So definitely pick that up. No special features again, same as Hollywood Shuffle, because Olive sucks at that so bad. Poor things. And I got two more. I'm going to do this one next because I'm going to save the big one for the finale. The other one I watched, a found footage flick called An Irish Exorcism, which is a documentary film crew goes around. They find out that, of course, the Irish Church and the Catholic Church have protected kind of the world of around exorcisms. They really do exist, but no one's coming out and saying they're doing it, or no documented footage that they're actually doing it and granting and providing priests to do the ceremonies or, you know, exorcism themselves to, you know, get this demonic force out of whoever. So anyways, an anthropology team goes to the Catholic Church to find out a child that is possessed. They edit. I can't think of the word.
Huh?
They get permission. Did you fall asleep?
I'm not editing that.
They get permission to film everything that's going on and document from the time that they meet the child to the end. It's your kind of your standard found footage film for the most part, especially because there's fucking shit ton of demon found footage films. But there's one thing that really clicks with this one is kind of the family that is trying to get this and how much the Catholic Church cares. But there's kind of a dark story behind of why the possession's going on, and that's kind of where the originality comes into play. Sadly enough, you don't get that until the last 15 minutes of the film, but it is a slow burn, and if you have the time to support kind of a smaller found footage indie flick, this could be for you if you enjoy that type of thing. And last but not least, I've never seen his fucking movie, and I curse myself. And I know BJ has probably seen it because I watched it because Zach said something about it. And I was like, hey, I have that. That was sent to me. I watched Harley Davidson and the Marlboro Man.
Yes.
With Mickey Rourke and Don Johnson. And oh, my God. Sean, have you seen this?
It is on my list to
this
buy.
Would be one of your favorite movies ever.
I remember when this so came good. Out. I remember seeing the previews for it. And, you know, I was super young, but I remember seeing the previews, and I've always thought about it. I've always wanted to see it. So when I saw it was coming on a Blu-ray, it's on my wish list. I need to pull the trigger on that.
Dude, Don Johnson is – I think I've kind of recently – rediscovered Don Johnson because, I mean, I always knew him as kind of the, you know, Miami Vice type shit where I was never 100% really into it.
What?
But I've actually – no, I know. But I've recently been watching Don Johnson movies, and why is he so good? Like, he's so likable. And the duo between Mickey Rourke and Don Johnson, as soon as they meet on screen – the chemistry and the charisma, it just flows so well on this flick. And this is basically these two guys have been buddies for a long time, get together, and they find out that their friend is having kind of their bar taken down by this what would you call fucking Tom Sizemore, this douchebag. Yeah, I mean it's a corrupt bank basically is taking over piece by piece of this town and buildings, and Harley, which is Rourke, and Marlboro, which is Don Johnson, get together with some old friends, and they try to shut down what is going on. That means kind of taking war on Tom Sizemore's gang, which is this film has like this futuristic feel too, which is really bizarre because it's a match because you have kind of, you know, Bon Jovi playing, you know, in the beginning, Mickey Rourke riding his Harley down there, meeting Don Johnson. They're like fucking shooting the motorcycles and shit. And then here comes is Alec, one of the Baldwin brothers, Alec Baldwin, like all these guys in their long black trench coats with machine guns. And it has this futuristic feel to it. But I don't know. It's just a badass action flick with just some of the great like buddy comedies. This is like one of the best buddy comedies that I've seen in a long, long time. So if you haven't picked this up or seen it, or if you haven't seen it in a while and need to revisit it, do it because it is fucking great. Which is also written by Don Michael Paul, who is an actor turned screenwriter for a little bit, who is in Dangerously Close that I reviewed on not too long ago, which is a badass movie as well. But yeah, definitely. I don't think there's any films I wouldn't. I think Quiet Gun's the only thing I wouldn't recommend in this. Oh wait, no, I forgot the Poltergeist of Poor Lee Forest. Jesus Christ. But anyways, that should give you enough movies to watch because I'm out of breath.
Holy shit. Holy moly. Where do you find time to watch all this shit?
Yeah.
I stay up like I am right now, 1:30 a.m. watching things, man. All right. I don't go to I have true. Like people listen to me for some stupid ungodly reason and these companies are like, "Hey, yeah, here." Well, all you right. know, you know, it's funny because I was talking to Nico B from Called Epics and he said, you know, he was like, "Hey, you know, I would like to come on your show again because these publicists are telling me about your show." And I'm like, "What?" He's like, "Yeah, I've had like three or four people, like as of recent, say, hey, are you going to be on the screencast again?"
Well, how come I'm not getting any shit?
Well, that's different. That's maybe because you don't. Hey, what's on your doorstep? This will like solidify this question probably.
Things I bought, but. Luckily they were cheap. The first things I wanted to cover, with the Poltergeist remake coming out, MGM?
MGM,
and 20th Century Fox, put out, Poltergeist 2 and 3. And I'd already had Poltergeist 2. I think it's the same, pretty much the same disc. So I finally pulled it out off the,
I thought that was new transfers.
I don't know. The transfer looked pretty damn good, so.
Yeah, I think they said they don't promote it, but I think they did from the elements because the original Poltergeist is like that.
Okay,
that could be. But, I mean, they look gorgeous.
I watched Poltergeist 2 and 3, and the 2 was the older one, and I was like, didn't know if it was a new transfer or not, but I thought it looked pretty good. But Poltergeist 2 is basically the continuation of Craig T. Nelson's family and
which is better?
The little girl. What'd you say? You say it's better?
Yeah, I like 2 way, way better. I did watch. What? I did rewatch 1 again, and I did like it a little bit more than last time. But yeah,
well, I'm a huge fan of the first one. I think the first one has charm for miles. I love it.
Absolutely.
It gets, the ending gets wacky and all the best of the ways good old 80s movies get batshit crazy. But Poltergeist 2 is kind of a continuation where there's a spirit or ghost still following the family and you know, I thought it was okay. Like it was all right. It had a few good scenes. Like there's one scene where the kid with the braces, all of a sudden his braces start sprouting out of his mouth.
So good.
In the bathroom. Holy shit, that scene. Like that's that scene's terrible. Incredible. Yeah. Like
that's some nightmare fuel for anyone who's ever had yes. braces. Oh my god.
Yes. So I thought like as far as that stuff goes, and when he you know drinks the worm in the tequila bottle and he goes a little crazy, and there's moments like as a whole like it's definitely not as good as the first one, but it has its moments.
Disagree. Disagree.
All right. So
well, it's two against one, so you lose.
So then I popped in Poltergeist 3, and this. Oof. She's staying at her uncle's house or something, and good old Tom Skerritt is in it, and I would ride Tom Skerritt's mustache for days. But, it takes place in like a weird office building that's also apartment building.
So weird. Yeah, it's weird.
There's that aspect. There's all these mirrors, and I kept thinking, I was like, is Sutherland gonna pop out of here? And is Kiefer Sutherland going to pop out and start looking
for ghosts? Sick reference, bro. Sick reference.
See, my jokes suck. But moving along here. I thought it was okay. Like, again, it had its moments. I think I liked it better than 2 as a cohesive story. And they keep trying, like with most sequels, you keep trying to one up, you know, each film. And this thing gets crazy with the mirrors and stuff. So still, like, both of these, I don't think hold a candle to the first one, but I think they're fun. They're fun to check out. And I think the 2-pack is pretty cheap, right?
Yeah. It's like, I picked it up for like $14. $14-15.
Yeah.
But dude, I think the second one has it like so hardcore with the scares and kind of the you know, those things. And also fucking Kane, man.
Oh, dude, you forgot. Yeah,
God,
Kane's awesome.
In his holy temple.
Like I said, like, lost? Each of these movies have their moments, and yeah, Kane's
pretty
badass.
Why don't you come with me, Caroline?
Mm-hmm. That fucking shit's creepy, man. I know. I think it got that family. Because I honestly, people say like the original Poltergeist has that family element.
Yes.
I don't think it does at all. I think the second and third one have that family element. It's just the story isn't well done in the second and third one, but the scares are better. I think if you took all three films and put them all together, you would have a kick-ass movie. But I think each one is missing something.
Yeah.
But I can agree with that.
I'm very happy these are out on Blu-ray. I've been wanting to check them out for quite some time. I had never watched them before, and it was just really fun to kind of visit these and see them for what they are. And you know, I like that they kind of go for the crazy and, you know, stick to it. So
yeah. And what the fuck is up with Nancy Allen in the fucking third one? She's like, oh man. Fuck Carol Ann. Leave her here, Tom Skerritt.
Yeah,
fuck that little bitch.
She hated her from the beginning.
She's like, no, we can't leave without her. We have to leave with her. And it's like, no, bitch, you just wanted to leave that little girl in the room getting killed, bitch. Yeah. Fucking Nancy Allen.
Didn't Heather O'Rourke pass during the filming of the third, or was it shortly after?
It was after. She, like,
it
got
was
pneumonia
after.
Or something.
That's right, because that's why her cheeks are so puffy.
Yeah.
Poor thing.
Yeah, that sucks.
That's the worst.
Oh, I'm gonna have a heart attack right now. Just kidding.
Wow.
It sounded like you were coughing. That was
I totally coughed. No heart attack.
That was some exaggeration going on there.
Yeah. That's Sean.
Moving along here. Finally, here's my. Oh, you know what? I got one more. Take it 2 more. I wanted to mention briefly that I'm a member of the Disney Movie Club or whatever.
Fuck yeah, you are.
They have Return to Oz out on Blu-ray.
Yeah.
And that movie is awesome, and it looks great on Blu-ray. And if you're a Disney member or whatever, go for it. I think you can find them on eBay and stuff for decent prices. But I just wanted to give a shout out that Return to Oz is on Blu-ray, and it's such a weird film. I had my kids watch it, and you know that the scene where the woman or the queen or whatever that takes off her heads and trades heads,
like yes.
That scene, that portion of the movie freaked me out as a kid, and it had the same exact it worked its magic on my 7-year-old son. He was sitting there watching, just eyes as big as saucers, and he's holding his neck like. I wish I would have had like heard his inner monologue, but that scene especially worked like gangbusters on the kids, and they were tense.
Fucking gangbusters.
That whole flick. Yeah, shut up, Brad.
This is exactly why you don't get promos in the mail. Because you say
it's
shit
a fantastic
like
gangbuster of a film, everybody.
But comes anyway. On you like gangbusters.
Yeah. Okay. I saw Return to Oz in the theater and when I was a kid. And I loved it, and it's on Blu-ray. And for those of you interested,
I have never been able to finish that movie.
You have
no
soul.
That movie traumatized me as a kid.
It's a fucked up film.
Like, because the first time I saw it, like, I don't sleep now, and I definitely didn't sleep when I was a kid. And it came on the Disney Channel at, like, 3 in the morning. I couldn't have been more than 7. I was really young. and it's like 3 a.m. I'm exhausted, and I just look at the TV, and it was like Return to Oz. I was like, I have no idea what this is. Let's watch this. Terrible, terrible decision. It fucked me up for so long.
There's that they're in that insane. They basically put Dorothy in insane asylum, and they want to do like basically lobotomize her.
Yeah, you know, it's with electricity up, man.
And the lady that switches heads is it's great. It's crazy that it even got made.
It's batshit and it's awesome.
All right. Moving along. Here's the movie that before I got sidetracked, that I want to talk about. We're all familiar with Gareth Edwards? Monsters. Hold on.
Yeah, Edwards.
Yes, Gareth Edwards. His film Monsters. And there is a sequel that he quote-unquote produced, but got turned over to another director called Monsters, Dark Continent. And I saw that this was
Consonant
coming.
Vowel?
Continent. Dark Continent.
The Dark Consonant. Much better movie.
Yeah. Well, they take the same kind of formula with we're in the world with these giant monsters. The giant monsters are still kind of in the background, but in this movie we're going to follow this military squad. And, you know, it's basically like, I don't know, Hurt Locker meets Black Hawk Down meets American Sniper with monsters wandering around. And it has like that military bro opening, you know, where they're doing things that I would never think of doing, you know, as they have these weird bonding moments where there's like strippers doing cocaine and everything and, you know, weird house party. I don't know about you guys, but that doesn't happen.
You That's know, strippers happened. And cocaine, bonding.
So it starts off with that kind of, and I that stuff I don't really connect with at all. But once things start going down, it's basically kind of like a military patrol or something goes wrong, and you know they need to survive or whatever. And there's giant monsters, and like for what it is, like I had a good time watching it. So I was pleasantly surprised that it didn't suck. The effects look pretty great. Surprisingly, I thought they were going to be more sci-fi level, just crap, but the effects were pretty solid, and, you know, it's not amazing, but if you catch this, like, on Netflix or whatever, I would say give it a try. So, have you guys seen this at all?
Yeah, I saw it quite some time ago. I saw kind of a rough cut of it, and I've been kind of wanting to revisit it, but it didn't intrigue me enough to actually do so right away.
Yeah.
But I will watch it again to give it another shot.
Yeah, I'd say if you know, rent it or stream it or whatever on Netflix. But I was pleasantly surprised once it got past the military bro stuff. You know.
Yeah, that's the main thing that kind of turned me off about it. Yeah. So
once they're in like a fight or flight situation, that those scenes get pretty great. So anyway, that's it. That's all I got.
Sorry, I took up most of your time.
You son of a bitch.
Wait till right. Next week.
Well, let's move into let's get Mr. William Lustig on the line here and chat with him. Today's guest, I am extremely excited to have on. Brad worked his magic and got a hold of Bill Lustig, director, of course, of Maniac, Maniac Cop, Vigilante, and then he's
Relentless.
And he's been heading up Blue Underground and doing a lot of restoration and things like that. So, Bill, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure for me to be here.
Well, we wanted to first talk about, of course, one of the main focuses of this episode is the Enzo Castorelli three-pack that's coming out with 1990 Bronx Warriors, New Barbarians, and Escape the Bronx, which is a hell of a trilogy, mm-hmm. and great that they're all coming out at the same time on June 30th, I believe.
Yes.
Just wanted to, you know, are you a fan of the apocalyptic cinema? Like, how did this come about? What made you choose these in particular?
Well, I can't say that I'm a fan of apocalyptic cinema. I'm, of course, a fan of movies like Escape from New York and Mad Max and, you know, those films. But I know the kind of cheesy charm the Castellari films have. And 1990 Bronx Warriors was the signature movie of that whole slew of Italian post-apocalyptic movies. So I decided if I'm going to put them out, I want to put them out as a complete set. And so it took us a while, but lassoing the rights to Escape from the Bronx was a bit of a challenge.
Yeah.
So I waited a couple of years before I had the rights to Escape from the Bronx so I could put them out complete. So it's a perfect evening's entertainment. You get a six pack and a joint. And you pop on the three movies back to back. It's a fun evening with your friends.
No, I agree. I mean, my very first step into kind of the apocalypse cinema when I was young was 1990 Bronx Warriors, because I was expecting, I was expecting the Warriors all over again, and I kind of stepped into a genre of cinema that I maybe wasn't prepared for at such a young age, because this is maybe when I was like 10 or 11. And, I very first put this on, I was like, what the hell is this? Like, this doesn't seem like my normal, like, blockbuster rentals off the, new release wall. It was just something completely out of the ordinary. But if it wasn't for Bronx Warriors, I mean, I would have never known who, I would have, but not probably as soon. But Vic Morrow and Christopher Conley, who I'm a huge fan of because he's in Raiders of Atlantis, and, the Hammer and George Eastman, just a slew of a great cast. So it's a hell of a pack, even from the director of, Inglourious Basterds putting these together. The only thing is, go ahead.
Well, you forgot one thing. Also, it features the real New York Hells Angels.
Oh, yeah, totally.
And that's a kind of a unique thing, because the Hells Angels, when you watch them look at Mark Gregory walk, it's hilarious. And you look at the faces of those Hells Angels guys, and they're watching what is supposed to be the macho hero walking with this obvious gay kind of, swishing, in his tight jeans and everything. It's really hilarious. And he's supposed to be like the leader, the one they're all kind of looking at. I find that to be hilarious. It's kind of featured who was the actual head of the New York Hells Angels. His name is Sandy Alexander. They cut to him a lot. He has a beard. Well, I guess all of them have beards. But I'll tell you a story about Sandy. He was in my movie Vigilante. And he played a kind of, he was on the picture, I think, for a day or two. And he played a scene where he attacks Robert Foster in the shower. With Woody Strode. I mean, Woody Strode comes in and rescues Bob from the other prisoners who are attacking him.
Yes.
And one of those guys is Sandy Alexander. And I didn't know who he was. And it's funny with the Hells Angels, they're so super polite. It's like, yes, sir. Oh, yes, sir. What would you like? Yes. And then I find out later, this guy is the head of the Hells Angels. After I got through shooting with him, I mean, fortunately, we didn't have any confrontation or anything. It was a very amicable relationship. But then a year later, I'm watching the news and he's being arrested for murder.
Oh my gosh.
It was either murder or attempted murder. And then he got released from prison, and then he got murdered himself.
Wow.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
So these guys, nicest guy, he brought his wife and his newborn baby to the set and everything. And it's just so bizarre. But anyway, getting back to the Bronx Warriors, it's interesting because he's kind of featured in it. He doesn't have any moments, but you see him a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. The one thing, because we actually did an episode around apocalyptic cinema a few episodes ago, and we covered Exterminator Year 3000, which is kind of complete garbage in a way. But the thing about with apocalyptic cinema is that, you know, whenever, you know, Escape from New York came out and Mad Max, I mean, all the Italian ripoffs, which we've already stated and came about, but there was a certain, you know, there was like the ripoffs that just wanted to make a movie and kind of repeat what Mad Max was doing and the Road Warrior. And then these things are kind of similar where they want to be kind of that, but they're so well produced and put together, even though they are cheesy and, you know, hilarious in many, many, many ways. But well, the one thing that these things film has is the charm of maybe they were actually really trying to make something worthy and could stand by, you know, Mad Max or the Road Warrior.
Well, I, you know, there was, well, he still is alive, a producer, Fabrizio De Angelis, who I think is someone who has been a kind of an unsung hero of Italian exploitation cinema. He was the producer of Fulci's Zombie, City of the Living Dead. He also produced 1990 Bronx Warriors and Escape from the Bronx and all this. Fabrizio De Angelis, as a producer, had a pretty remarkable track record of making genre films that really rose above what was being produced by other Italian companies. So yeah. I have a real respect for Fabrizio. It wasn't an accident. The guy really had taste and knew what he was doing. In fact, on the three discs, we have a three-part interview with Castellari in conversation with Fabrizio De Angelis.
Oh, man.
Yeah, and it flows. Those flow really, really well together because each disc has, you know, I think Bronx Warriors has the first part, New Barbarians is two, and then Escape from the Bronx is the third one for people that aren't familiar with the trilogy.
And what you see with Fabrizio is a very intelligent producer. This guy, when he's talking, you could see he's very, very thoughtful about what he's doing and really cared about the films he was making. And I can tell you how rare that is. I mean, I worked with a lot of people in the film industry when I was making movies, and most of them are not, you know, they're good businessmen. At best, they're very good businessmen. But as far as creative producers, they're very few and far between.
You know, I think a big portion of that is because I was looking up, you know, because watching him speak and, you know, just about where his history came from. Because, I mean, he worked with Fulci in the very, very, very beginning and, you know, produced all of Fulci's films, which I always considered Fulci one of the better filmmakers in the horror industry. Not mainly because his films are – I think his films are a little kind of wonky because – of the translation with, you know, with the Italian and American cinema and of course all the ADR that is put in afterwards. But his films are so well produced and they look so good and they're beautiful. And I think coming off right off of Fulci's films into this trilogy, I think that speaks for itself. Also, I mean, they were all made within what, a year of one another, and they probably reuse the same sets and same shit like that. I mean, they reuse the same actors too, but I mean, it's the whole trilogy behind it. But it's just, yeah, I agree that, you know, these are the types of apocalyptic films that we kind of wanted to see when we wanted to rent the knockoffs. And I think this is what people will get. If you're a fan of apocalyptic cinema whatsoever, these are the three films that you should check out, you know, before you start, you know, getting into the, well, I mean, even 2019, Fall of New York is really great. But I mean, Warrior of the Lost World and stuff like that, where it's just complete cheese. These are too, but it's a different type, you know. Yeah,
these have been on my list to check out for quite some time, you know,
well,
when I started.
I mean, I think, like, for instance, New Barbarians, it's about as cheesy as you're going to get. However, there's a couple of moments in that movie that really, you know, are like, huh? Like when it was being sodomized by the villain.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's pretty explicit. And I was like, you know, when I first saw the movie, I'm going, this can't be happening. You know, it's something like you could hear people joking about when they were writing the script, but to actually shoot it and to do it in a way that it's more than just implied.
Right.
Well, yeah, no, that was a cult classic that was cut for a long time, because it was, I remember growing up and trying to get a hold of, you know, because it was always Warriors of the Wasteland that I knew it at that time. And I didn't even know it was part of a trilogy, but trying to get that. And eventually when I did see it, I believe it was cut, because then I saw the uncut version, you know, a few years later. And I was like, what? Like, I don't remember this. I thought I would remember that when I was 13, you know.
I think this is needless to say that all three films had suffered over the years censorship issues. These the films, the versions we put out are the complete, uncut, unedited films transferred from their original camera negatives.
Oh, wow.
So it's not, there are no cuts whatsoever.
Where did you guys acquire the negatives from? These types of movies are starting to come out more and more, and I'm becoming fascinated with, you know, what goes into distribution and restoration. Were they in a vault somewhere? Was it hard to track down?
I must say, in Italy, they really did take care of their negatives. Hmm. I mean, there were a couple of times when I had issues like Django. We had, you know, the negative was in a flood, and so there was some water damage on the negative. But I would say for the most part, the Italians really did, you know, they took care of their negatives. And so, you know, when we license the films, we make it a provision to get access to the original camera negatives. And we do the work in Rome because we are working from the original camera negatives, which we don't want to ship abroad.
Yeah.
Oh, well, yeah. Do you know if Raiders of Atlantis is hopefully in there? Because you know, that's that one thing where I can't find anywhere.
I no have one not is releasing it. To be honest, I have not searched for that film.
Can you, Bill, please?
Well, I think for a while, I think we've taken care of our apocalyptic films for a while.
Son of a bitch. So,
I mean, I like to kind of vary what we do, not kind of stay with one thing.
Yeah, well, that's the one thing I also wanted to ask is because, I mean, Blue Underground has been so prominent with you know, reviving kind of, you know, the oddball in cinema, and also, you know, doing some classics such as, you know, your films as well. But now it just seems like since probably September of last year, you are just cranking these out one right after the other and doing incredible transfers and, you know, some really, really great work, kind of putting some of these other companies to shame that are trying to do the same thing. Can we expect more of that in a continuation?
Well, yes. We have. Look, the company at the end of the day releases on average 10 movies a year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's our average output. At least it's been that way for maybe the last 5 or 6 years. It was a little more aggressive when we started the company, but it's sort of come down to about 10 movies a year. And, so that's, you know, that's what we do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you just take the time because, I mean, your discs are also stacked. I mean, with special features and, you know, it's just not, you know, slapping it on a HD master wherever you get it and putting it out. You're actually taking the time and putting all the commentaries together, which you're very familiar with because, I mean, Blue Underground started as kind of a documentary for Anchor Bay, correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah. Now, I was always curious. I mean, I'm sure it's in an interview somewhere, but from your mouth, I would like to hear it. Now, Anchor Bay used to be Video Treasures, right? And then it became Anchor Bay. Where was your involvement, and where did you start up, and how did you get in with that? And with a departure, of course, creating just Blue Underground in itself. Like, can you give a roundabout history of that?
Sure. In I'll try to make it brief. Sometime around 97, 98, I was approached by a gentleman by the name of Jay Douglas, who was running Video Treasures. And what he wanted to do was put Laserdisc type transfers on VHS for collectors who didn't have Laserdisc players. So we started working together doing that with some of the films that I had acquired and I was putting out on Laserdisc. And at some point he came to me and said, look, we want to get into the DVD business, but we don't really have anybody who knows, you know, the technicalities, you know, that you know, of doing DVDs. And I didn't either. You know, it was absolutely brand new. And so he asked if I would dedicate 6 months to help them get their DVD business up and running, which meant doing new transfers, creating bonus materials, and all the rest of the stuff. And so I started with them with the Halloween, which was a double disc with a lenticular cover. I don't know if you remember that when it came out. And that 6 months grew into about 4 years.
Yeah.
And I was acquiring films and putting them out through Anchor Bay, as well as producing the DVDs for Anchor Bay of films that they had acquired. So we had a full-time operation. We were putting out eight DVDs a month.
Wow. Yeah, I remember when you guys very first started coming about, because I was like, you know, because you were releasing the films that I wanted to see, and also the, you know, just some of the VHS tapes that, you know, weren't available at that time or a little bit more expensive. I mean, now they're, you know, cheap as hell, but, you know, at one time these things were very, very, very expensive. So.
Yeah.
Glad always to go to the store, especially like Best Buy, and actually find some of these things where, you know, they were being put everywhere.
Yeah, it was an interesting time.
Now,
what happened was, at some point, I got word that the parent company of Anchor Bay, a company called Handelman Company, had put Anchor Bay on the sales block. So I realized that the handwriting was on the wall, and I better start doing something. I had all these people that were employed, look, you know, kind of relying on me for their income, and I too, you know, saw that things were coming to an end. So we sort of transitioned into making Blue Underground its own label. And that was in 2002.
Yeah. Well,
ever since.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I had, and I'm sure other people would be interested, is that you mentioned when you said when you started is 97. Well, that was also kind of the end of your you being in the director chair. Now, is that something that was, you know, can we ever expect you back in the director's chair, or did that Blue Underground kind of take the reins on that?
Well, you know, when you start a company, you have responsibilities, and it's hard to go off and for, you know, for 6, 8, 9 months and direct a movie.
Yeah.
But having said that, I see the possibility of it happening sometime soon, you know, because Blue Underground kind of runs itself at this point, and there are less and less films to acquire. So it's I see the future in of you know, being you know, of directing again.
I'd love to see a nice return of the gritty, grimy New York. That's for sure.
Yeah, it doesn't really exist anymore.
Yeah, I was telling. Whenever I talk about your films, I'm always the films you've directed. I whenever I always associate them with just that portrayal. Even if I see it in another movie, it just takes me back to, you know, a maniac and vigilante, most notably, are always coming to mind, and just the grittiness. I mean, I'm assuming New York that around that time, that's just how New York was, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was a rough and tumble place when we made Maniac and Vigilante, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, nothing of what it is today. Today it's totally Disney-fied. I mean, yeah. I'm still praying that a terrorist blows up the M&M building.
Well, that's what happens when you invite all the hipsters to town. You had mentioned earlier about films from back then were so much, you know, grittier and more graphic. Nothing was really implied, and how now we as a culture are sort of seeking out these films that have been edited and looking for their original forms. But at the same time, new films that are being created are, I guess, they're wimping out and they're not giving the, you know, graphic and gritty nature of the films of yesteryear. And there's that weird sort of, we're craving it from our older films, but we're too afraid to deliver it from our new films. I just want to know what your thoughts are on sort of that.
Well, the truth is, I see far more gore in mainstream movies today than I ever remembered. And they're getting R ratings. There are things that I've seen in some horror films. Nothing comes to mind immediately, but I have seen in contemporary horror films scenes that certainly would have gotten an X rating back in my day that are in an R-rated movie. Hmm. I think the difference is that when we were making analog movies, and today it's digital. And something about the cleanness of digital,
right,
that subliminally makes things feel more fake, and
yes,
less. It has, you feel less of a visceral involvement with, you know, the violent acts because they feel so fake.
Yes.
And they feel so cartoonish, and they've got a cleanness to them that we didn't have. Also, because we were restricted by not having access to computer technology, somehow the way we depicted violent acts somehow felt more organic. Because we couldn't do it in a way that we could do anything we wanted. We were kind of restricted in order to create the illusion for the audience. I don't know if this makes any sense.
Yeah, totally.
It makes complete sense. Yeah.
But, you know, you watch, for instance, Dawn of the Dead. There's now, obviously, there's no CG. I'm talking about the original Romero, Dawn of the Dead. And yet, you have some acts of depictions of violence and that are so visceral. You know, just that simple thing of, for instance, the machete hitting the zombie's head, which, you know, Tom just cut out a space in the machete for the head and just did the shot in reverse. And so you know, it really feels like, you know, the guy's getting hit with a machete. You know, there's just something that feels more real about the, you know, analog horror films.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, I mean, I haven't seen anything that disturbed me as much as there's two movies that have totally disturbed me that I have trouble revisiting. One's Maniac. And the other one is Portrait of a Serial Killer. Like, those two movies, I saw them once, and they have stayed with me since I've seen them. And I haven't had that with any other horror movie, just, you know, that visceral reaction to the film, like, where I'm like, I immediately need, I must have a, like, layer of dirt and grime and, stuff on me. I need to go take a shower immediately after watching this movie. That's how I felt after watching those.
You know what's so funny? When people talk to me about, like, when the subject of Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer comes up, do you know what the scariest moment for me in that movie was? When the camera pushed in on that suitcase at the end of the movie by the side of the road. I thought that was so frightening.
Right.
You know, and for me, it's always been like that. I've never been someone who really found graphic violence or the depiction of graphic depiction of violence to be particularly scary or disturbing. It's always been, like, for instance, I would say in recent horror films, there was a shot in It Follows of someone walking across a lawn.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Yeah.
And but that creeps me out.
Yeah, no, it was you know, because you're sitting there and you're watching something in the background and you start to have that buildup of nervousness. That, like, wait, is anybody noticing what is happening right now? Am I the only one? Yeah.
That is the kind of stuff that really creeps me out. When people ask me what scares me as a horror, that's the stuff that scares me. And I thought that, like, it reminded me of the movies that, of years ago that I just loved, like Carnival of Souls. That movie to this day scares me. That scene when they're dancing around that empty carnival, whatever, gazebo, I don't know what you call it. It was like a, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
That scares the piss out of me. You know? Anyway, that's me. That's where I come from. Yeah.
Well, I think a big part of that too, with going back to kind of the, shooting on film versus digital, I mean, it does give us a sense of realism. Because I mean, we live in a dirty, nitty gritty world anyway. So when we see something so clean, it takes kind of the fear out of it because it's too polished. Now, my main question with that is, being that Maniac is gritty and dirty and filthy and it makes you feel like you need to take a bath and it haunts you, then we have Maniac the remake that is clean and pretty and polished and very neon, but I still enjoy the hell out of the remake of Maniac. But since you made that statement, I mean, how did you feel about kind of the digital remake of Maniac? I mean, were you hoping for something as gritty, or were you just giving the artistic freedom of the director?
Well, firstly, I didn't have any creative input into it. I mean, it was Alex Aja's film all the way, and with my blessing. Mm-hmm. What did I think of it? I mean, I have to say, my first impression was that when they had the scene at the beginning where the girl's throat is cut.
Yeah.
I was disappointed that they did that at the beginning of the movie, because I kind of felt, again, this is me, and again, it could be a generational thing, but I always feel that when you go out and shoot your load in the first couple of minutes of the movie, where do you go from there?
Yeah.
You know? So that's the kind of stuff that, you know, that I kind of felt that they, in my mind, I would have, like, as an example, I thought it would be a lot more effective had the camera, let's say, when he takes out the knife and he goes to cut her throat, if the camera was to pan off of her with the rhythm of his hand and cut to a silhouette on the wall, and you see maybe the blood dripping out of her by a black and white silhouette on the wall with the title Maniac, I think that would have been a lot more visceral for an audience, because you're not showing it to them right away.
Yeah.
That's me. You
know? And that would have been beautiful.
Like, you know, I thought, like, having the view by transposing the subway scene from my maniac to this maniac, I mean, the problem with the L.A. subway system is it looks like you could eat off the floor.
Very true.
You see, my subway scene in Maniac came from an experience I had as a messenger. I was a foot messenger in New York, and I used to ride the public transportation, mostly the subways. And I remember being in this deserted subway station and trying to get out of it and going to the end, what I thought was an exit, and I go up the stairs and it was all chained. The gate was chained. So the only way I had to go was back where I came from. And I thought to myself, even at that moment, before I was even knew I was making a movie, I was making movies in my head. I was thinking, what if somebody was chasing me or following me? I'd have no chance to get out. So my scene in Maniac was all about being trapped in a cage. She enters this cage when she pays her token fare. Huh. She has a sense of danger. She goes to try to get on the train. She's too late. The train pulls out. She decides she wants to get out of there because she feels, you know, that she's that her life is in danger. But when she goes up to the other stairs, that entrance is all chained up and she can't get out. So she takes refuge in a bathroom. That was sort of the beats for me of what I did.
Yeah.
Problem in the remake, by doing that scene, they entirely missed the point, or maybe decided to discard it, of what my subway scene was about. By doing this POV shot, it makes it feel kind of weird because it's a widescreen POV shot and she has a million places to go.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking to myself, this is stupid. Where, you know? And then she gets on the train, then she gets off the train, and again, she's on these streets where it's just, by doing the POV thing, you just sense that there's no, she's not trapped at all. I mean, I thought to myself when I read the script, when they sent it to me before it was shot, and she goes into that parking lot, okay? I honestly thought when she went in the parking lot that it would have been really cool if she decided to bang the hoods of the parked cars in order to set off their car alarms in the middle of the night, and the car alarms would go off and the flashing headlights and stuff of the car alarms would happen. So you would have this kind of strobe effect inside this enclosed parking area as she's trying to save herself from this killer who's following her. That's maybe what
it's gonna happen. Maybe you should remake Maniac.
Instead, he just becomes a victim, uh-huh. And there's no battle. There's no strategy. It just becomes, you know, whoops, I got the jump on you, and you know. And the coolest thing, I guess, what it was when it pans onto the reflection on the van, and it's sort of an homage to the poster.
Huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a horror film or a suspense movie. It just, to me, just did not cut it. But yet, I know a lot of people who love the remake.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a completely different film. I'm a big fan of the remake, a huge fan of the remake, actually. I mean, but I love the original just as much. I mean, in a way, it's not even we say remake, we throw it around so loosely. I mean, I think it's more like more or less a revisioning of, you know, just kind of a new age. What would we do if we try to make a film like this? What can we get away with? What can we do new? And what, how can we kind of pay homage to the film itself? But yeah, I mean, it's extremely interesting to hear your thoughts on it, because I mean, I don't never heard that before. You know, because yes, I mean, you no creative input, but you gave the blessing, and you know what you saw was, you know, you not the happiest or a little bit disappointed.
Well, I was so. I honestly, at the end of the day, I was kind of disappointed. Yeah. But you know, I don't. I have no. I think Alex is a great guy. Frank, all these people, I think, are extremely talented. They did what they believed they wanted to do. And you know what? Maybe it would have never, maybe nobody could have ever made, a movie that I would have been satisfied with.
Yeah. I mean,
you know, that's maybe the truth.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, I am prejudiced because I made the original movie.
Well, my next question goes hand in hand with that is, you know, there's the talk of, you know, kind of a reboot, sequel, prequel to Maniac Cop.
Yeah,
but now is that something that you have creative input in, or are you producing, or what's the status kind of on that, if you could say anything?
Yeah, I'm working on it with Nick Winding Refn.
Yeah.
And it was written by Ed Brubaker.
Oh, the comic
artist or yeah, writer,
criminal, and you know, he's you know, you guys probably know his work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you know, it's it's very different than my Maniac Cops. It's a very, very different take on it.
But are you satisfied?
Well, again, you asked that question.
Yeah.
And the truth is, I would like to give the people the benefit of the doubt and see how the movie turns out. Mm-hmm. But I can't really. I guess my frustration would be that, you know, it's in the same way I've talked about Maniac. It's you know, I just have a different vision.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily a better vision. I mean, Nick is an enormously talented filmmaker. You know, Ed is an enormously talented writer. You know, I mean, I just turned 60 years old. These guys are in their early 40s, so there's a big, you know, there's two generations difference, and you know, my time has come to hang it up.
Well, I think Refn's vision with just Only God Forgives. I mean, I think he can nail that nitty gritty, because I mean, he definitely does it in that. Yeah. Even though it is polished and pretty with the neon lights, there is kind of this grimy feel to the film where you feel dirty. But my main question, another main question for the Maniac Cop, is that are you wanting – do you want to do this film more, or are you putting it off? Like kind of what's the status on – or is it affecting at all the recent escalation with cop brutality in America? Are you wanting to do this a little bit more, or – is there kind of a statement behind there that they're trying to put in, or is it just they want to remake Maniac Cop?
Yeah, I mean, the remake of Maniac Cop was something that began about 2 years ago. And so it predated the recent slew of cop, you know, situations. And the script really doesn't, at this moment, the script does not have any, does not reflect that at all.
Okay.
So it really did not, it doesn't really go hand in hand with that.
Okay. Yeah, I was just curious because that's, definitely a question that, I mean, because one thing I have noticed in a lot of forums and comments is people mention, like, oh, man, this would be a great time to remake Maniac Cop with this recent escalation in cop brutality. But, I mean, yeah, there you go.
See, that's here's the thing that I think a lot of people miss about Maniac Cop is the character was never intended to be a cop who goes out and kills people. It was intended to, I mean, what I'm trying to say is the character of the Maniac Cop was a cop who once was an aggressive cop who was really fucked over by the system. I mean, okay, Maniac Cop was, I thought of Maniac Cop as, imagine if you combined Dirty Harry with Serpico and
okay.
And you, so you had a cop who was a well-intended cop who took his job very seriously, was aggressive on crime, but his aggression was running afoul of the corrupt system that he worked under. And very much like what happened with Serpico. And instead of like with Serpico, who was set up and got shot in the face, they take Cordell and they trump up charges, throw him in prison with the very prisoners he had put behind bars.
Yeah.
Where he is attacked, and now we have a ghost on the streets. A ghost who is haunting the very city that he had once protected. That, to me, is what Maniac Cop was about.
Yeah, I mean, with the first film with Cordell, because, I mean, we have a cop who's going around, you know, violently killing people, and then we soon realize that, you know, he was sent to the Sing Sing prison, and, you know, he was framed, and obviously, you know, we all know how Maniac Cop plays out. Now, I mean, with the Maniac Cop sequels, I mean, they take a kind of a new height to brutality. Was that kind of like your same goal, was to make kind of Cordell? I mean, because there's also, we get to know Cordell a little bit more, especially in the third one. You know, two and three, you get to know him a little bit more, but it does escalate. So it almost becomes kind of a slasher film at the same time.
Well, I mean, I have to say, I really have disowned Part Three. I did the movie. I did it for the money, you know, it really. I tried, but I was really dealing with, you know, I was dealing in a committee, and it really just was a disappointment for many reasons. It was not the script that Larry wrote. It was we had to change it at the last minute. I mean, I go into it. There's a documentary that's on the Blu-ray.
Yeah.
And I honestly talk about what went wrong with the film. Part two, I just the opposite. I embrace the movie. I love it. I think it was the best movie I made. And
well, that's good, because so do I. So, yeah.
It was it really allowed me to make the film that I wanted to make of the Maniac Cop. Again, as I said, I think of the Maniac Cop is at its core a ghost story about a cop who had been wronged and is now back to get to avenge what happened to him. And the people who wronged him. Mm-hmm. That was my thinking on it.
Okay. Well, I just want to say that Maniac Cop 2 holds one of my favorite scenes of all time, is the police station raid.
Oh, yeah.
That gives me the biggest boner, just to tell you right now. But I always wanted to ask, is there any homage to Terminator in that?
What?
Any homage to Terminator?
Oh, of course. It was a
okay. I love it. That's all you have to say. This conversation's over. That's all I wanted to know. That was the whole goal, to ask you that question.
The first person to get shot, a guy who's wearing a shirt and tie, the first one when he enters the actual station itself, not when he's going up the stairs, that's my brother, who I blew away.
Awesome. Well, BJ or Sean, do you have any questions? Because I'm gonna stole
every question that I had.
I'm sorry. I'll talk about Relentless.
Sit in the quiet corner over here.
Where are you guys located?
We're all over the place.
I'm in Southern California, and Brad's in Florida, and
I'm in BJ's Cleveland. I'm in Cleveland by way of Chicago. I don't know why I moved here.
I'll tell you something interesting. I wonder if it still exists in Cleveland. Just outside downtown Cleveland, I was taken to. I actually went to this place twice. It's called Johnny's Room 24. Have you heard of it?
I have not. Now I need to find this.
I don't know if it still exists, but it was really a trip. It's one of these things that I always expected to see on, like, Anthony Bourdain or one of these type places, one of those shows. It's, you ready for this? It was a terrific limited menu steak and seafood restaurant that is in an abandoned motel room. And there's like L-shaped. Hello?
Hello?
Oh, no, we're here.
It was like, you know, like an L-shaped motel. When you look at it from the road, it's in the middle of, it's kind of like, it's surrounded by woods, it's dark, but in the corner where the L kind of meets is, you'll see, you know, there were lights. And you'd see, like, when you look closely, you see these high-end cars there. So when you go into the restaurant, you go in through the room, through the door of this motel room. Well, it's no longer a motel room, but it's a converted restaurant, and you walk past like a cold a refrigerator of wine and beer and stuff, and then you walk further in, and it's like six tables in what was once a motel room.
Wow!
I have to find this. That sounds fantastic.
What?
I said I need to find this. It sounds fantastic.
It is. It's and it was. And the guy who owned it walked around wearing slippers, and they served the food family style. So, you know, you sit at a round table, they bring out a bowl of salad, then a bowl of pasta, and then you choose, like, they have like two different kinds of red meat and a couple of kinds of seafood, like crabs and stuff. It was the most amazing experience I ever had when I was in Cleveland.
Wow.
Let's all go. We can find it, at least.
Yeah, let's go. Now you all have an excuse to come visit me.
There you go.
It was really good. When I was there, like, the head of, like, the, you know, one of the Cleveland teams was at the next table. You know, they had photos of Frank Sinatra on the wall. You know, it was pretty interesting. It's a one of a kind.
Awesome. It is on my list now.
Please let me know, BJ, if you find it.
I will. I'm going to be on the look for that. That's what I'm going to do when we're done with this podcast. I'm going to start Googling immediately.
About 10 minutes outside of downtown Cleveland. I was staying at the Holiday Inn in downtown, and it was about 20 minutes from there, maybe 20, 30 minutes.
Awesome.
Okay. Awesome. Yeah, I'm looking that up immediately.
You may not find it. I mean, it's really weird. It may not even be listed in any phone books or anything. I'm sure they don't have a website.
Well, maybe I can find them on, like, the crazy underground forums.
It was a cash-only place.
Oh, that's even better.
Yeah, but the bills, you'd be there with, like, you know, like five, six people, and the bill comes, and it's $1,000. Yeah. Anyway,
that's all. Hey, I'm BJ. Please report back. Let us know.
I will. Absolutely.
I'm supremely curious right now.
We'll have the next podcast at the restaurant.
Yes. Bill, I think it's we'll be wrapping up here shortly, but what do you guys have? These I'm super excited for people to get their hands on these three Blue Underground releases, the Bronx trilogy, I guess is what I tell people it is. But is there anything coming after that that we should be on the lookout for?
Have you guys heard of the Stranger Films?
The Stranger Films?
They were a series of spaghetti westerns made in Italy, of course. Starring an American actor named Tony Anthony. Did you ever see a movie called Coming At You? It was the first 3D spaghetti western. Or Treasure of the Four Crowns, which was a kind of a Raiders of the Lost Ark in 3D. Any of these movies ring a bell?
No,
not at all.
Not ringing a bell, but I want them to ring a bell.
They all star Tony Anthony.
Wow.
His real name being Tony Petito, from Brooklyn, who found his way to Italy and became a European and Asian movie star. Not very few people know him here, except for diehard film fans. And what happened was I acquired the rights to the final Stranger movie. There were four that were made. I acquired the fourth one. The other three were put out by MGM and are available through Warner Archive now. Tony Anthony has been out of the public eye, pretty much in this country forever. But he also kind of disappeared. And I found him in West Virginia. And I have been spending the last 2 months talking to him about every couple of days, and the stories he has about making movies during that period is phenomenal.
Bill, thank you so much for taking the time and spending some time with us and chatting about your career, Blue Underground, and your films. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you all. It's really been a pleasure. And BJ, let me know if you find Johnny's Room 24.
I will. I'm really excited to track this down. Even if it doesn't exist, I'm going to go find it anyway.
You need to do a write up of some sort, even about this thing. Cause
yeah, it sounds nuts. Yeah. I got to find it. Even if it's just the shell of what it used to be.
I actually had their card at one time, and all it was a red card with a side angle of a motel key, like with the old fashioned plastic thing, dangling from it. And it just said Johnny's Room 24, and it had their phone number. Nothing else.
Wow.
No address, nothing.
Fantastic.
Wow.
This is a mystery that must be solved.
I'm going to solve it.
All right. Did you guys have anything else for Bill before we let him go?
No, he answered my Terminator Maniac Cop 2 question. That's it.
Oh, come on. That was, like, ridiculously easy.
I just wanted to hear it from you because it's always, like, that scene has always stuck with me. Like, every, like, filmmaking in general, like, that's one scene that has made me want to be a filmmaker just because I think it's just so fucking badass.
Well, I must tell you, just about every scene in Maniac Cop 2 had its roots in another movie.
Yeah.
By way of example, have any of you ever seen Jackie Chan's Police Story?
Oh, yes.
Do you remember at the beginning, there's the police raid on that hillside shanty town, and the cars started to go down the hill and smashing into the shacks and everything?
Yeah.
It was the very first scene of Police Story. There's a moment where a girl is handcuffed to the steering wheel of a car, and I thought that car was going to go down that hill with her handcuffed to the steering wheel of the car, but it never did. So I just did it. And that's the genesis of the scene where she's handcuffed to the car.
That's incredible.
I did the scene. I did the scene from Police Story that I wanted to see.
See, this is why you need to get back in the director's chair. I think you have a lot more in you, sir.
Movie, that scene was inspired by what movie? When he goes to the police station and he goes on fire. The original, Howard Hawks, The Thing.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Burst in the place. They light the electrical. He goes on fire. He bursts through the wall and runs into the snow. I just took it and elaborated on it. All I was saying to everybody is we're making The Thing, except we're going to, you know, everything we did, of course, I was doing it, you know, amplified.
Right.
Same thing with the Terminator-style police shootout. I mean, all that stuff was all trying to, embellish.
But I think that's one thing that films are missing these days. I mean, just not taking Maniac Cop 2, but kind of that fun, outrageous, but still kind of realism, you know, kicking somebody and then flying across the room and, you know, just like when Cordell just starts walking through the walls and all the glass starts breaking. I don't know. There's a certain charm to those 80s films that hasn't really – like we try to emulate those films and, you know, we put the VHS grain and tracking – shit on the film, and that's supposed to make it old, but a lot of those films don't have that charm like these films did. That's a little upsetting to me. That's one thing that hasn't carried over yet.
I can tell you now firsthand, the difference is while we were making like movies like Maniac Cop, it was like my whole crew were a bunch of kids, and we were giggling and having fun while we were making the movies. We felt as, you know, now there seems to be such a silly seriousness about making exploitation films. In fact, if you call them exploitation films or you call them B-movies, it's as though you're saying something dirty.
Yeah.
You're saying something, oh, God, no, we can't be doing a B-movie, you know. And I always say, just have fun. Go and feel liberated when you're making the movie. Instead, there isn't that you know, the look, it seems like the only films that are interesting are the ones that are made outside of conventional movie financing.
Yes.
A movie like It Follows would never be financed by traditional Hollywood financing. And yet, it's the best horror film to come around in many, many years.
Fuck yeah, it is. There you go. Now, see, people that are listening, fucking Bill Lustig said that shit.
Well, I'm just saying that, you know, what you get when you put it through the convention is, through the machine, is you come up with something that gets the fun kind of sucked out of it.
You get friggin' Jupiter Ascending is what you get.
You know, I don't. You know, it's just you. There's something about the traditional, financing mechanism that just sucks the life out of projects.
Hmm. Yeah.
And for me, I see it and. It's sad because when I think back to making Maniac Vigilante, Maniac Cop 1, Maniac Cop 2, Relentless, even Hitless, we were all having fun. We would come to work, we were laughing, joking around, you know. It was you know, we had tough times, don't get me wrong. There was stress. But it was always we were working to entertain an audience.
Right.
Because we were entertaining ourselves.
Yeah. I'm hoping that will change with kind of the more recent, like, Mad Max Fury Road, where fucking, you know, George Miller's making the film that he wanted to make. He just went balls out crazy, and that film does emulate a lot of things from the 80s where maybe that it doesn't feel like it exists in this world right now, but it does. So hopefully we can get more shit like that, you know, but
well,
who knows?
Honest to God, I didn't like the new Mad Max.
Yeah.
So I'm in a different thing. I thought – Tom Hardy, he's a really strong, wonderful actor, but he's an actor and he's not a movie star. And that movie suffers because it has no heartbeat. You have two leads who are in my way of thinking, they're heartless. So you, and when you have a movie like that, it really makes a difference. When you have a Mel Gibson who you just feel tremendous empathy for. And with Tom Hardy, I didn't even know what he was doing. And Charlize Theron, wonderful actress, but she's not, you know, she was there. Her role was that of, just emotional, emotionless. I gotta tell you, and it also again just looked like one big cartoon to me. The action didn't feel like had any jeopardy to it. It felt repetitious. Nothing like the first two Mad Max.
Nothing on Road Warrior.
But I think Mad Max 1 and Road Warrior are masterpieces. They're two masterpieces.
Bill Lustig just shut me down.
Those are very good points, though. Very good points, and those are criticisms that I have actually heard. But
criticisms that I have. So,
oh damn!
I was so checked out with Tom Hardy. I was like, man, that was a waste of Tom Hardy.
Mel Gibson had that magic.
Yeah.
I watched Mel Gibson in a recent film that was a straight to video bomb called Get the Gringo.
Oh, it's great.
And he is charming in it. You know, forget all, and this is like post all his, anti-Jew raids, tirades and everything. And you still like the guy. I'm watching this movie, I'm going, I would love to see him in more movies.
I agree. I'm a huge Mel Gibson fan.
I think all of our best stars have to be a little bit crazy.
I think so.
Yeah, look, he was the best thing in that stupid Expendables movie.
Oh yeah.
You know, I don't know. That's what this new Mad Max to me was missing.
Huh. Yeah, I can see that.
You know,
have you ever looked into film criticism? Maybe we can start a podcast with Bill as a film critic.
It's great.
This could be very, very fun.
Pulls no punches.
Well, one more thing about Max. When they're doing all that exposition at that citadel at the beginning of the film, did anybody understand those Australian accents? I may only have heard like a third of the dialogue.
Wait, there was exposition?
What? I'm looking for subtitles. Anyway,
that's great. One last thing before we go. There was an interview write up is it Diabolique? Am I pronouncing that right? Diabolique magazine. And at the end, they ask you about physical media and everything, and where do we go from here for physical media? And you said something here that I actually is the first kind of great thing that I'm clinging to my physical media, but what you said basically was that it's not necessarily about the media and the technology, it's about the movies. And I thought that was a really great thing to say, where we're heading with film technology.
Well, look, right now the way I see home entertainment, it's really it really boils down to three segments of the three distinct quadrants of customer. You have first the consumer. That's the majority. Those are the people who want to watch a movie when they want to watch a movie, and they don't care if they see it on a disc or they see it digitally. They just want to see the movie and go on to the next movie. Mm-hmm. That's the consumer. That's the majority. That's all of most of our friends and family are those group. The second group are the collectors. That's the customer for Blue Underground. And those are the people who really cherish the best presentation, and essentially want on the disc a forensic of every detail of the movie they just saw.
Yes.
And they want to get it from whoever still exists who's connected with that movie. So they get the most thorough understanding of the movie as well as seeing the movie in its best incarnation. They are the people who are willing to pay extra to buy a Blu-ray to get, you know, to get all that bells and whistles.
Yeah.
Then you have the third consumer. And that consumer is the one that wants to buy four movies on one DVD for $4.99.
And I hate those things.
So that's how I look at the world of home entertainment. And I've obviously planted a flag in one of those worlds, and the other two are what they are.
Yeah. Fantastic. So you guys are you have no plans of going digital or offering anything like that?
I do. We have available digital.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't necessarily make it available immediately. I think we're making the apocalyptic films available immediately or shortly there, shortly after Street Day. But for the most part, we hold back a little bit, but then we put them up digitally because there's still a customer that wants to watch it that way.
Yeah.
I'll watch stuff on Netflix or on Amazon. But, I still maintain my account with Netflix where I get a Blu-ray, where I get Blu-rays.
Yeah, no, we're all big. I mean, that's the reason why we created this podcast was because of physical media, because all of us are
hoarders.
I mean, my VHS collection's fucking ridiculous. I mean, even I'm still getting rid of shit and I still have a, towering fucking tapes. But, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's I think it's important. So.
Yeah.
Great.
Well, listen, I think how long is your podcast normally?
We are over the allotted time, but we wanted to kind of go with the flow here and
This is all over the place on this one, Jesus.
Yeah,
but, it's good though.
but we are good. Bill, again, thank you so much for being so gracious with your time. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's my pleasure. All right. Well, listen, have a good night, and we'll see you at the movies.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for this week's podcast. I want to thank everyone for listening, and, of course, thank Bill Lustig for spending some time with us. Fantastic conversation. I had a blast listening to Brad interview him.
I was too busy crying in the corner because I was so happy.
No, it's good. Brad, way to handle that interview, man. You did awesome. So
thank you to Greg Chick, who is kind of one of the other head dudes at Blue Underground for setting that up.
Yes.
So
absolutely.
Yep. Of course, if you go to coffeeshopofhorrors.com and order a coffee from them, use the code Screamcast to get 10% off. Listen to one of us, the other shows over at oneofus.net. And visit nerdly.co.uk. Those they are major supporters of the show as well. If you haven't yet, grab Wolfmen of Mars new album Gamasu. Their vinyl release is coming very soon, but it is available on Bandcamp right now. And I believe it's made it to iTunes by now as well. So check that out. You'll hear the tune that they wrote for us for the show. You'll hear that tune in all its glory on the album.
It's so good.
It's good stuff.
It's so good.
And I think that's it. If you buy movies and they arrive on your doorstep, hashtag what's on your doorstep, and we will retweet that shit. It's fun. I love browsing through the hashtags. It's good times. And finally, I need to give a huge shout out to those guys and gals over at the GG. TMC, the Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema Facebook group. There's also a podcast, The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema. I posted, I asked them if they had any questions for Bill Lustig, and they gave me a few ideas that I jotted down. If you're on Facebook, check out The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema group and join them. They're fantastic. And, oh, yeah, go to the screamcast.com, and we got mugs and shirts available if you want to support this support the show by wearing swag and drinking coffee from the mug.
Yeah.
And don't forget that we now have, if you go to Grindhouse Video, you can type in a we actually have a code now that will get you 10% off your order, which is Screamcast10, and that is the number 1010. So go on there. They got a bunch of crazy shit. And then don't forget also that this is a smaller company, so they might be a tiny bit high. Are you vaping?
What?
Are you vaping?
No, I'm not.
Great. Whatever. But, you know, I mean, you have Amazon, and they try to match as well as they can without, you know, because obviously they're very independent. It's one guy running this company.
Don't do friggin' Amazon match. Like, they can't compete with that.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you want to give the extra dollar to, I mean, places like this could open up around you, because if it's in fucking Florida, like, there's other places these businesses can be that would do a lot better than what they're doing here. But support the little guy, and definitely look through their stock and purchase from them what you can, 10% off, which is not too bad. So.
All right. All right. Very cool. BJ, did you have any shout-outs, or are you good?
I'm good.
All right, cool.
If I want to shout you out, I'll shout you out on Twitter. I'm on it 24/7, so.
Nice. All right, everybody. We hope you guys enjoyed the episode. We'll talk to all of you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Oh, don't tell me you're leaving. The party's just begun.